A little bit of macroeconomic policy on the program today, of course. Then some blackjack. We'll do the carbon market. And hey, take a couple of days off, will ya? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, 12 July today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. If it is safe for you to do so at the moment, and you happen to have some loose change in your pocket or your purse, toss a coin for me, would you? Heads, the economy is fine. Tails, the Fed is going to cut rates at the end of the month. Yes, a trick question, because both are true. But that's only half, maybe a quarter of the story. Here for the rest of it are Catherine Rempel. She writes for The Washington Post. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai. Okay.
Catherine, let me start with you and put this question to you. The Fed Chairman Jay Powell went to Capitol Hill today, said, in essence, the American economy is fine. We're a little worried about global headwinds. And so we're going to cut rates because why?
Because there are those risks out there, including, as you pointed out, global headwinds, trade policy uncertainty. He talked quite a bit about that at the prompting of members of Congress as well. So there are risks out there. The headline numbers look good, but the goal of the Fed, as he put it, is to prevent us from getting into a recession, to keep it looking, you know, pretty good, not to wait until things get so bad that that it's a little bit too late for the Fed to catch up and try to make things better.
Sudeep, the cynic in me says, you know, he's doing this because the market wants it, the market expects it, and what the market wants, the market gets from the Fed.
Yeah, some people think he's being bullied by markets. Some people think he's being bullied by Donald Trump.
Right.
And Jay Powell would love nothing more than to just say, you know, everything's fine, everything's going to be fine, markets go away, Trump go away, leave me alone, we've got a strong economy going here. But he's already seeing signs of trouble. You see in the bond market signs of trouble, classic indicators of a recession at some point in the next 18 months. We're seeing it in global trade data suggesting that a recession could be around the corner. None of this means that it's absolutely going to happen, but this is a risk management approach that a central bank needs to take.
Sudeep, let me stay with you for a second really quickly on this and the chairman's relations with Congress. It was clear that for all of the president's sniping at the Fed and the chairman that he appointed, the members of Congress that questioned the chairman this week have his back, full stop.
Yeah, they don't like the central bank chairman being bullied by the president. They don't like the idea that everything is going to be a political game with political manipulation, especially in this environment where the president seems to be trying to do that all over the place. Yeah. And so they're trying to stand behind him and say, do what you think is right. It's a very different situation. Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen would have loved to have this from Republicans to say, you know what, we trust you, follow the data, do what's right. But at least Jay Powell has that now.
Catherine, there are some vacancies on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. The president has not officially nominated, but floated some names of people about whom you wrote this week. Her name is Judy Shelton, and she is an interesting choice. Explain.
She's an interesting choice in that she's kind of a crank. and she has also reversed many of her long-held policy views. So she's been consistent on some. She's been very inconsistent on others. You know, during the Obama years, she said hyperinflation was around the corner, things like that. The Fed and loose fiscal policy as well were debasing the currency. That zero interest rates or ultra low interest rates were immoral. They were theft from savers, et cetera. Now she's calling for zero interest rates. Before she said that the Fed was listening too much to the markets, to trying to appease markets. Now she thinks they should be trying to appease markets. So she's reversed herself on many of those kinds of policies. And in that sense, she seems similar to some of the previous Trump Fed picks who had ultimately failed. But in another sense, she has been very consistent, which is that she wants a return to the gold standard and she wants fixed exchange rates worldwide, which is quite extreme. And I think if Trump actually understood what that meant in practice, he probably would not have nominated her.
Yeah, but super.
It just,
Go ahead.
Well, it's just in conflict with many of his own preferred policy stances.
Super quick, though, Catherine, compared to Stephen Moore and Herman Cain, she looks relatively good and thus will get confirmed, question mark?
Well, she doesn't have the same kind of personal baggage that we're aware of with Moore and Kane, in the sense that they were both dogged by personal scandals, particularly sexism.
Right.
You know, Kane was accused of sexual harassment. So in that sense, I think if that's the bar, I guess she clears it. But in the sense that, you know, it doesn't look like the Fed would necessarily be held to its current standard of political independence, and that she wants to blow up the global international monetary system, you know, senators might have some reservations.
Speaking of blowing up the global international system, Sudeep, it is worth a mention here that the Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, came out either yesterday or today with a letter, in essence, begging the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, to raise the debt limit before Congress goes away for its August recess, else the Treasury Department will run out of money. Here we are again with the debt limit. What are the dynamics and what's going to happen? You got 45 seconds.
The dynamics are a little different than they were during the years when Republicans were using it as a cudgel on the Hill. Obviously, Democrats want something. They want to make sure they get what they think they deserve in government funding fights, but they don't plan to use this the way Tea Party members and the Freedom Caucus have tried to use it, of give us everything. We're going to, like, gun to your head, give us what we want. Otherwise, the entire economy goes down with us. So that's a good sign that it's being treated a little bit differently. This will likely get through in a relatively clean fashion ultimately, but we should just expect a few fits of drama from the Hill, because it wouldn't be Capitol Hill without
just that. Just because that's the way it goes. Sudeep Reddy at Politico, Catherine Rempel, she writes for The Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Wall Street was taking Jay Powell's semi-promised rate cut all... No, he did basically promised. Come on. They were taking it all the way to the bank. Record highs on all three major indices. The S&P closed above 3,000 for the first time, which, as with the Dow above 27,000 yesterday, that and $5 get you a skim latte, extra foam. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With the caveat that we try real hard on this program not to get all jargony, there are days when you got to do what you got to do, and today is one of them. Jargon in question is something called the Phillips curve, which says that the lower the unemployment rate gets, like it is right now, inflation should start getting higher and higher, like it is right... Well, no, that's the point. Unemployment is really low, but inflation is basically flat. Here's why I mention it. This week, during his testimony on Capitol Hill that Sudeep and Catherine and I were talking about, Fed Chair Jay Powell said, basically, the Phillips curve, once again, the relationship between unemployment and inflation that has been part of the standard framework for decades, Powell said that doesn't really work anymore. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what broke it.
The unemployment rate in the U.S. is 3.7%. That's pretty good. People having jobs it's great. And actually, it's part of the Federal Reserve's job to keep unemployment down. But the Fed has a fear that if the unemployment rate gets too low, prices could rise too much in the economy. It's also the Fed's job to keep prices stable.
If demand is very high, you're going to see prices rise.
Stephen Cicchetti teaches at Brandeis International Business School. Because as the labor market gets tighter, wages do tend to rise. They've been rising a little. And the idea is that with those bigger paychecks, demand goes up, prices go up faster. That has happened before, but it is not happening now.
The link between domestic wages and domestic prices is much weaker because of globalization.
The economy is not a cute little self-contained box. We buy stuff from all around the world, so prices are affected by things all around the world. So it's harder to say, gosh, wages are going up, so prices must too. Also, another reason it's gotten harder to tell when inflation is going to get out of control is it's actually been forever since inflation was out of control. Alan Detmeister is an economist at UBS.
The Fed has been very good at keeping inflation relatively constant since the late 90s, so that inflation doesn't get into individuals' expectations.
What he's saying is inflation doesn't get into people's heads. They don't worry about it. Companies aren't paranoid about it. They don't change their prices that often. So inflation doesn't really move much or very quickly. On the one hand, all of this is to say that it's gotten harder for the Fed to tell whether the unemployment rate is too low, whether high inflation is just around the corner. But the flip side is, maybe it's not all that urgent.
They can focus much more on the real side of the economy.
The Fed probably doesn't have to worry too much that anything crazy is going to happen with inflation all of a sudden anytime soon. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
We asked Jay Powell about inflation and that unemployment link when we talked to him last summer. He basically shrugged. You can hear the interview at marketplace.org. Secretary of Labor Alex Acosta has another week in his job. He resigned today over his role in the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking case a decade ago. We will leave it to others to unpack the scandal part of all of that and take a look instead at what Acosta's Department of Labor has been working on and what might be coming next. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is on that one.
The Labor Department is charged with looking out for the well-being of laborers, job seekers, even retirees. In the 2 years Alexander Acosta ran the department, he had the same mandate as President Trump's other cabinet members, deregulate. Bridget Dooling is with the Regulatory Studies Center.
If you look at what they completed during Secretary Acosta's term, there was clearly an effort to roll back earlier Obama rules.
Like the one that would make more workers eligible for overtime pay. But Acosta wasn't moving fast enough for some. Trey Kovacs is with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which advocates for business deregulation.
He certainly took what I would say is an overly cautious approach and took a long time to reverse course from the previous administration.
That slow timeline earned the grudging appreciation of many labor activists. Judy Conte is with the National Employment Law Project.
We felt that for the Trump administration, the Acosta Department of Labor was far better than we feared.
Now she expects all that to change. Under the new acting secretary, Patrick Pezzella, who used to be deputy labor secretary, she says that deregulatory push is likely to speed up.
We certainly know that they will continue to try to gut the overtime reform and to make sure that employers have less and less responsibility to create good jobs for the workers.
She expects a lot more legal fights over labor issues ahead. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Maybe you took some time off after school got out. Maybe you're waiting to get away till the end of the summer just to have something to look forward to. But whatever your preference, we are deep in the heart of vacation season now. Kinda. The U.S. Travel Association says more than half of Americans who get them don't use all of their paid vacation days. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino explains why it is so hard to unplug.
You really couldn't pick a more relaxing setting than the vacation spot of Jennifer Calkin, a public relations manager from Silicon Valley.
I'm in beautiful Hawaii, and I have a beautiful view. It's just magical here. It's paradise.
She's been taking advantage of her jet lag to rise early and start the day. Not with a sunrise walk on the beach or coffee on the lanai, but some alone time with her devices.
It starts with emails, and then it goes on to my instant messaging.
Because even in paradise, it's hard to let go.
There's always a part of me that has a bit of the toe in the water on work, even when I'm vacationing, just making sure nothing urgent is going on that I need to be responding to.
While Calkin doesn't sound too bothered by it, that wasn't the case for sales auditor Evan Soddy of Chicago. Several years ago, he was working for a demanding startup where just the effort to tie up loose ends at the office before vacation was brutal.
I just remember the week plus of work I had to go into it to make sure that everything was taken care of. Like, it was that level of just sheer panic.
When he finally made it to Hawaii, he immediately opened his emails and found some demands from his CEO waiting.
I just remember sitting there on the plane while everyone else is getting their bags from the overhead and just feeling depressed, just knowing that the vacation hadn't even started by that point. But I was just like, oh, goodness, already with this?
Inability to disconnect from work denies people the considerable benefits of vacation, says Brian Robinson, a psychotherapist and author of the book Chill, Turn Off Your Job and Turn On Your Life. He says a growing body of research shows taking time off actually increases productivity by making workers more resilient, improving cognitive function, creativity, and problem solving.
That's why I say always take a vacation, not a guilt trip.
Robinson is a self-confessed former workaholic who says he used to smuggle work documents hidden under the spare tire of his car on family trips. Now he counsels others who find it hard to take vacations.
because they're afraid that somebody might be vying for their position, or their manager might perceive them as slackers or not a team player.
San Jose software engineer Ron Buencamino has tried to find a happy medium. He finds it easier to take multiple mini trips, extending the weekend by a day or two here and there, and never traveling more than an hour or two away.
You know, you're within distance to be able to tend to your responsibility if you absolutely need to, or, you know, you're still in the same time zone where if you have to jump on a phone call or respond to some emails, you're at least, you know, still cognizant of the time everybody's working.
A recent survey from travel insurer Alliance Global Assistance found more than half of Americans were taking these so-called microcations in place of longer trips. But with technology keeping us hyper-connected at all times, Robinson says these short trips may not be enough.
It takes the body a while to adjust to the shock, actually, of just sitting there looking at something. They can't watch the waves in the ocean, or they can't look at the sun rising over the mountains, because they start to feel antsy.
Ron Buencamino is prepping for his first actual long vacation next week and doing the unthinkable.
No, I am not taking my laptop. I'm taking my iPad with me, but I'm taking off my work email. I'm taking off messaging.
A vacation from devices and the guilt. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
When you annoy people, it's great because then they leave the table.
A trip to the casino. Straight ahead, but first, sure, let's do the numbers. I would have gone really happy music, but that's just me. Dow Industrial's up 243 today, 0.9%, 27,332. The NASDAQ up 48 points, about a 0.5%, 8244. The S&P 500, 13 points to the good, 0.4%, 3,013. For the week, the Dow up 1.5%, the NASDAQ up 1%, the S&P 500 0.7% higher. Shares of Johnson & Johnson fell 4.1% today after Bloomberg reported the Justice Department is launching a criminal investigation into whether the company lied to the public about cancer risks associated with its talcum powder. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.11%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, it's Kai, and I want you to listen to the latest episode of Make Me Smart. This week, we are talking about history. It is not just names and dates. History helps us think critically about why things happen, and it gives us context. But are we collectively losing interest in it? And if so, what do we do about it?
There is something that's been lost, and we've got to agree on a common set of facts, and we've got to agree to understanding all sides of history. And if we don't want to do that, we really have a problem as a society.
Make Me Smart. Find us wherever you podcast. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I'll tell you what, if we hadn't just done it, I would cue the gang in the control room to hit the happy music again right about here, because there is a bull market and an 11-year high in carbon. The European carbon market, to be precise. Every industrial company in the EU, every power plant, has to buy carbon allowances, basically permission slips to put CO2 out into the atmosphere. For years, it cost almost nothing to pollute over there, but the price of those allowances has really ramped up of late. And as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now from the Sustainability Desk, as with more straight-ahead consumer items, the more the price of carbon goes up, the more people are going to change their behavior.
Europe's carbon emissions market turns 14 this year, and like other markets, it gets exciting when the price goes up. Now, what's traded is not a stock, but an allowance to emit 1 ton of CO2. For years, that price per allowance sagged at the equivalent of less than $10. That made it very cheap to pollute, says Ken Kimmel, president of the Union of Concerned Scientists.
You want that price signal to be high enough to drive people to make changes in their behavior. And so if the price is too low, it won't be achieving all of those effects.
But in the last couple of years, it has surged to over $30. Traders are betting it'll get harder and stricter to emit carbon in Europe. For instance, Germany is completely phasing out coal, says economist Dallas Bertrand with the research center Resources for the Future.
In the EU, there are a number of member states really ramping up their climate ambitions in a way that has not been adequately noticed around the United States.
In this country, the Trump administration has been pulling out of climate deals and regulations, but there is carbon emissions trading at the state and local level. California's market pulled CO2 allowances out of circulation to tighten supply, raise the price, and discourage carbon pollution. And the Europeans borrowed that approach, says economist Robert Stavins at Harvard.
The higher the price goes, the more the incentive effects are, which power plants are turned on. And in the longer term, with regards to technological change, building new power plants, new types of motor vehicles, etc.
That is, the higher the penalty on fossil fuel products, the more low-carbon innovations can compete and be in the money. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Blackjack players among you will know the term counting cards. For those who don't play, it's a way, by literally counting the values of cards that are dealt, that players can know when the odds are in their favor and thus when it's time to bet big. Blackjack is the world into which our podcast This Is Uncomfortable takes us this week. Host Rima Crace has the story of Rose Travis, who joined a card counting team and started seeing money in a whole new light.
Rose's first big break with card counting came unexpectedly. It was the early 2000s. She was a graduate student, and she'd built up a bankroll of about $10,000 to invest in blackjack. One weekend, she was on a four-person team headed to Reno when
our main big player suddenly couldn't play. I don't know if there was a flyer out with his picture on it, but he was kicked out immediately.
So she stepped up.
This is my first time being the big player.
Being the big player means waiting for signals from her teammates that the count is good, and then coming in and laying down big bets. The team rarely had women play this role. It just drew more scrutiny. Rose knew that she'd get a lot of questions, like, where are you from? Or, where's your boyfriend?
It's just not as common to see women betting thousands of dollars at the blackjack tables.
So Rose came up with a plan. She'd bet, and her teammate Cliff would pose as her boyfriend.
He would be handing me money and I'd be playing. And so maybe that would look a little bit less strange.
That's so wild you had to think about all those things.
Yeah. And so we came up with this kind of, I was this kind of wild, drunk, like party girl. And I had this cowboy hat that I was wearing.
Rose and her team, which was made up of people with regular jobs, you know, attorneys, accountants, they'd often come up with different personas. Card counting isn't illegal, but if casinos catch you, you can get kicked out. So it was 3 a.m, and Rose, along with 3 of her teammates, trickled into the casino, ready to play.
There's like tumbleweeds going across the casino.
She sat down with her fake boyfriend and waited to get signals from other teammates. Once she did, she started causing a scene, chatting up other players, laying down huge hands.
And when you annoy people, it's great because then they leave the table. And it's better for your odds when you have less people at the table. So,
oh, my God. This is so elaborate.
So the goal was to annoy people. I was, you know, taking off my hat and swinging it around, asking, you know, who's going to be drinking with me? You know, do you want to get drinks? Drinks are on me, even though drinks are free.
Cliff was playing the role of the frustrated enabler.
You know, he kept kind of tapping me on the shoulder, like, let's leave now. And that was the whole dynamic that we had come up with.
Meanwhile, Rose only got more obnoxious, lifting up from her seat, downing tropical mocktails, you know, can't be drunk on the job, and shouting for free stuff.
We need a room with a hot tub and, you know, I need a bottle of Cristal.
It seems crazy to me that they'd intentionally draw all this attention to themselves. But Rose says it's kind of like reverse psychology. It can be less conspicuous to be a hot mess than a focused player. Rose is playing big hands, $500, $2,000. And it was just win after win after win.
It was scary because I just hadn't dealt with like that much actual cash before in my hands.
Counting cards had changed how she thought of money. Like, she'd never in a million years buy a $1,000 dress, but she'd easily bet that much in a single hand.
You have to kind of distance yourself between the value of money and what you're doing with the money in the casino. Because if you look at it as, well, this is $5,000. Mm-hmm. Like, what can I do with this $5,000 in my life?
Right. It so, almost yeah. sounds like you're treating it like Monopoly money.
Yeah, it has to be. I mean, in a way it is. It's like when it turns into chips, it's not money. And
it's just part of the game.
It's part of the game, yeah.
Sitting at the table, Rose could also tune out her student loan debt, her credit card bills, what her bank account actually looked like. Money at the casino gave her an escape, even if it was only temporary. I'm Marie Mejres for Marketplace's new podcast, This is Uncomfortable.
Check out the new episode of This is Uncomfortable to hear more of Rose's story, in which that casino trip, by the way, took a turn for the worst. This final note on the way out, in which Starbucks, too, abandons print newspapers. The company said this week it's going to stop selling hard copy papers in the 8,600 stores it owns and operates in the United States. That'd be the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and USA Today. End of August is the cutoff date if you're a hard copy coffee drinking kind of person. All right, we're going. The Dow Industrial is up 243 points today, 0.9%. The NASDAQ gained 48 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 up 13 points, 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizal. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.